Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Catherine Whittaker and David Law are back in the UK, and I think jet lag free, Catherine. What do you think?
I'm sleeping a lot. It's difficult to know where jet lag ends and just catching up on sleep begins, isn't it?
Okay, well, not to worry. We'll talk about tennis anyway, because this is the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph and Amazon Prime Video UK, who brought you the US Open, courtesy of Catherine Whittaker presenting. They'll be back with the Laver Cup at the weekend, covering that as well. Worldwide, more than 200 countries. Catherine and I will be watching. We'll bring you a show straight afterwards. And there's loads of tennis to talk about today, Catherine. First of all, though, how's your week been back in the real world? Because New York doesn't really feel like the real world, does it?
Yeah, but I'm not sure sort of being comatose in bed is the real world either.
No, probably not. how many hours of sleep have you averaged?
Oh, 11.
11. You've averaged. Well, I mean, you did actually describe an 8-hour sleep as a nap to me the other day.
Yeah, that was accidental, though. That was the day I got, you know, when you have an overnight flight and you land in the morning and there's just no way you can push through. My dad actually came to pick me up from the airport, which is lovely. I was in such a desperate, exhausted, jet lagged state in the car, and of course we got stuck in rush hour driving into London traffic, and he was like, do you need me to pull over? And I was like, no dad, just get there so I can go to bed. And then yeah, I just had a full night's sleep in the middle of the day, and then a normal night's sleep that night. I slept for 20 of the first 24 hours of being back.
Yeah. You did describe, you also did miss out the 3-hour top-up that you told me about in the evening.
Yeah, fell asleep on the sofa that night, and then, yeah, I mean, I just, yeah, all non-drug assisted.
Right, okay.
It was great. Yeah. It was absolutely great.
She wouldn't have even failed
the
test.
How about you, David?
Well, nothing like that, let's just say that. But anyway, I feel like full of beans, and I don't care whether I've had enough sleep or not.
You sound alarmingly full of beans,
yes.
David.
Well, I've had a good weekend of tennis watching, which has involved the Davis Cup, which we're going to get on to. We're going to be talking about what is effectively the final weekend of proper Davis Cup as we've known it over the last 117 years. I say we've known it. I've only been alive for 45 of those, Catherine for considerably less. But anyway, it's been going on for well over a century. It won't be like that anymore. We'll talk about that and about what is to come, this brave new world that we're going to be entering in 2019. We're going to talk a little more about the fallout from Serena and Carlos Ramos-gate, although not too much, because I've been getting it in the neck for continually talking about it. But I do feel like more stuff has happened. Enric Molina was our interview. We got some reaction to that.
David, if they're bringing it up on Question Time, then I think on a tennis podcast we're justified in still talking about it. On Thursday, there was an audience question about the Serena-gate on Question Time.
How did it go down, before we get off the subject for now?
I don't know. I didn't watch it because I find Question Time puts me in a bad mood.
Right.
I was made aware that was the case.
Okay, fine. Well, we'll do a little bit more on that because there's more stuff to discuss. We're going to talk about the results of the week. There have been some interesting ones, although not massively high profile outside of the Davis Cup, but there have been some that I'd like to get on to. There is pole vault, of course, Catherine, which you'll be disgusted to hear is back as part of the show. But I think, first of all, certainly from my standpoint, and I think that this is very fair comment from many of our listeners, a word or two on Naomi Osaka, because it does feel as though she got a bit lost in it all. We did try to give her dues, etc., but you know, it isn't what it would have been in terms of reaction. But I tell you what it has been. It's been certainly noticed in her sort of lap of honour and her kind of celebration circuit of all the shows that she's done. She did the Ellen DeGeneres show in the States. She went back to Japan, and in fact, she's playing in the Tokyo tournament this week. She's got Dominika Sibulkova as her first match. But how do you think she's handling it? I mean, because from my standpoint, the way she looks, she seems to be handling the whole rigmarole incredibly well. I mean, there's such a fuss being made of her. There's such a lot of talk about how much money she's going to end up making and what it all means sort of in terms of, you know, the business of tennis. But she doesn't seem to be reacting to anything any different to how she reacts to most things, certainly publicly.
Well, she's obviously a woman with a very even keel. So, yeah, unless she is incredibly different in private to how she's in public, and she certainly doesn't give the impression that she would be, then it seems to be going very well. You don't know what her internal monologue is, do you? I mean, yeah, I've heard lots of... I think, actually, on BBC Radio this weekend on Fighting Talk, which is like a comedy sporting panel show, Naomi Osaka was introduced. The topic of Naomi Osaka was introduced as Naomi Osaka soon to be the world's highest earning female athlete, as if that was just, you know, a fait accompli. And that very well may be the case. We're all aware of how much money there is in endorsements in that part of the world. And she also sort of appeals to, it's awful to talk about it in terms of appealing to markets, but, you know, she also appeals to the American market as well. So, yeah, that very well may be the case. And I think she announced two big new endorsement deals this week, one with Nissan.
Correct,
I believe, and one other. What's the other?
I can't remember, but...
Anyway, there were two big ones this week, and I'm sure there are others, and I'm sure, you know, can you imagine the dealings that her agent is doing behind the scenes? But she seems to be just, you know, doing her thing and taking it in her stride and going on the Ellen DeGeneres show, like, you know, oh, right, I'm on the Ellen DeGeneres show. And everybody that I speak to that knows her a bit, you know, speaking to, you know, comms managers at the WTA, everyone seems really confident that she will be unchanged by it. Really, really confident. Obviously, you can never know for sure, but they have a lot of confidence in her that she will handle it one way or another. You know, she could have a dip in form. Sloane Stephens lost 8 matches in a row at the end of last year. I don't think anything like that will happen. But a dip in form is not the same as, you know, going off the rails and being overwhelmed by the whole thing. I'd be surprised if that happened.
The bigger question for me is whether she is okay with this just lifestyle-wise, because we saw what it did with Angelique Kerber. We had our long discussions about introverts versus extroverts. I don't know which Naomi Osaka is.
You don't know which you are yet, David.
No, so. I haven't done that. What's that test I've got to do again?
Myers-Briggs.
Oh, yeah. Right, I'm going to do that after this podcast.
Nothing to do with Simon.
No.
But as far as I know.
Two very good Briggs as far as we're concerned. But anyway, straight after this podcast, I'm going to do the Myers-Briggs test. And let's see if Naomi Osaka, if she's listening, suggests she does it as well, just to find out what's coming. But the reason I ask is because we talked a lot about Angelique Kerber back when she won her first slam. And I mean, look, let's be honest, she went and backed it up and did all the rest of what she did. She reached the Wimbledon final. She reached the Olympic final. She won the US Open. So it's not like there was an immediate downturn in her fortunes, but you could tell at the end of that year, or the following year rather, that she just had enough of all this chat and all this attention. The one I would compare it to, going back to when I first joined the ATP circuit, is Pat Rafter, who won the US Open in 97. And I remember meeting him, not for the first time, but sort of the first time in a full-time role that I was in at the ATP as a communications manager in 98, in the February of 98. And what it was clear with him was that he just hated all the responsibilities that came with his endorsements. So, yes, off the back of this massive win, he'd got four or five big contracts worth, you know, considerable amounts of money, but each one of them required him to give certain numbers of his days up to those sponsors. And he just didn't look comfortable with it all. And he basically admitted it, you know, I don't really want my life to be like this. And that's a balance, isn't it? Because you have got an opportunity cost there with your life. What do you do with it? Do you maximize it for financial gain, or do you just say, well, I don't want my life to change? And is it actually possible to be at that level of celebrity and that level of success without your life changing?
Yeah, I mean, it's no different to the sort of equations and opportunity cost decisions that normal non-Grand Slamming people have to make at various points in their lives. You know, what price do I put in the broadest brushstrokes term, what price do I put on my happiness and maybe even my sanity? And we're talking astronomical sums of money. So obviously the temptation is going to be at its most extreme. But she said that she's not that into money. You know, the problem you have is that she's a 20-year-old. I don't know her agent at all. So there's absolutely nothing personal to him, but just, well, I assume it's a him. I think it's a him. They usually are. Just speaking to Daniela Hantikova, you know, she speaks very profoundly about the pressures that you're under to take these deals. You know, even if you have, you know, she said her family, she trusted the advice of her family completely, and obviously they weren't in any way interested in exploiting her, yet she still felt an obligation to take deals because she felt throughout her career she owed a lot to her family because of the sacrifices they'd made to get her to where she was. So even though they weren't applying any pressure to her, she applied the pressure on their behalf, if you like, because she felt indebted to them. And then you do have agents and so on, people that are profiting from you and may apply unwanted pressures and so on. So for a 20-year-old to try and cope with all of that, and I'm sure there'll be some missteps in there. Her parents look solid to me. I mean, her mum looks great fun. Her beaming smile and tears when Naomi won they'll live with me for a long time. But it looks to me like the basic ingredients are probably there for her to more or less handle it reasonably well. But I'd be surprised if there wasn't the odd misstep in there. She's a 20-year-old that's about to inherit the world.
I think the other thing is, given what appears to be her potential, it will be interesting to see how much she wants to win. Because I think if she wants to win enough, she's going to do a heck of a lot of winning, you know, because the basics, we saw them in that final, just how good she is. You know, we'd seen it in the run-up to that. But to bring that game that had been winning 6-love, 6-1, 6-1, 6-love against the also-rans and then start dishing it out to Serena.
Against decent players, David. Yes. And love against Sasnovich.
I know, who I've just been watching and fighting it out with a good player like Anastasia Pavlyuchenko in Tokyo. And the idea that she would just get wiped off the court is a hard one to fathom, really, unless Sasnovich was ill. So assuming she wasn't ill, that is an example of she's got everything. Osaka as a player, it would appear to me anyway. So it'll be fascinating really to see her journey, her arc in the sport. So we'll see. Tokyo starting this week. We've just had Davis Cup weekend. It results-wise saw Croatia reach the final for the second time in 3 years, beating the United States 3-2. France also winning 3-2 against Spain, although you could not get two more different ties. Croatia with 2-0 up, and the States came back into it, won the middle day doubles. Then Sam Querrey upset Marin Cilic 2-2, and then it was Borna Čorić against Francis Tiafoe, and Tiafoe led 2-1, and eventually Čorić won it in 5. So an incredible tie in Zadar in Croatia. And in France, well, it was 3-0 and over and out in 2 days, and eventually Spain won basically the two dead rubbers. So that's the final. What did it make? How did it make you feel watching that 3 day spell, knowing that Davis Cup is never going to be like this again in quite this way?
It made me feel like they definitely shouldn't have bothered playing those two dead rubbers in Lille. And it made me feel like if I was a ticket holder, I'd definitely rather have had a refund than watch those two dead rubbers. I know that's why they do it. I think if you've had four live rubbers, they don't play the fifth one. Is that right? Or is it maybe it's to do with the quantity of time that the crowd gets, quantity of tennis. But I know I would have felt annoyed about that. I mean, that's not three, reporting that as a 3-2 scoreline in terms of rubbers is ridiculous. That was that was a 3-0 scoreline, and then they played a day of exhibition tennis.
Yes.
Well, you said it very well on Twitter, actually, in relation to the Croatia United States Davis Cup tie, which, as you said, had everything, was absolutely compelling. Was any bit, you know, this is as good as Davis Cup gets in terms of drama and players caring and all of that, and you know that what's on the line, qualifying for the, you know, the last ever sacred, truly sacred Davis Cup, as many would see it. And yet, would anyone in America really have been caring? I mean, obviously some people, but generally speaking, would it have registered a notch on the sporting news Richter scale in the States? Probably not.
No.
And that's a problem. That's a problem. If that's Davis Cup at its absolute best, let's be honest, we could do with America caring about it. I mean, partly it is that they don't have any players on the men's side that grab headlines and attention, with all due respect to Sam Querrey, and maybe Francis Tiafoe could be that one day, but he's not yet. But even so,
it's not that though, Catherine, because they used to have Sampras and Agassi, and yes, okay, if you went back to the days of McEnroe, maybe people over there cared more, but the format and the competition, it lags so far behind the Grand Slams, whereas Ryder Cup in golf doesn't. Ryder Cup is people take notice of it, no matter what the media you might be reading and listening to and watching is covering it in the United States. It's just different. And I mean, that you could come up with various reasons as to why that is, but fundamentally, I think trying to explain to people what's going on in the Davis Cup, that this was a semi-final in September, and oh, if they reach the final, that's in November, oh, and then we start again in February, that has been problematic for a long time in a lot of these markets. And you look at the TV market for any team outside of your own. Now, I don't, well, okay, that's unfair. I don't want to speak for every TV market in every country, but certainly in the UK, I could not find anywhere to watch Croatia against the United States. The only place you could watch it was if you subscribed to the ITF's and Davis Cup's sort of stream. And that's not good enough. That isn't available to enough people. People don't know about that enough. So yeah, it's problematic that TV broadcasters do not want to pay that rights fee to cover a team that is not their own country. And so much as I think is being lost, and that tie showed you what is going to be lost, because you're not going to get a tie like that, best of five sets, best of five rubbers. You're not going to get that anywhere in the world, even with the home and away ties in February of next year that will lead to the eventual final. You're not going to get that again. So there is stuff being lost. And you're also only going to get it once a year as opposed to four times a year. But neither one of them is perfect. And some people have come to me and said, well, you were saying this end of season thing is going to be great. What are you complaining about now for? I think what we've discovered and what we've concluded from the whole Serena Williams, Carlos Ramos, Naomi Osaka situation a week ago is that things aren't always absolute. Things aren't always, yes, this is my opinion, and I'm going to back it to the hilt no matter what. Because there's a lot going on, and they've got to try to reach the best conclusion, and I don't think either one of them right now is the best conclusion.
No, I agree. I mean, exactly as I discussed with Charlie Eccleshare in our podcast where you were swanning around Croatia, David, at the time of the ITF vote, I don't feel that strongly either way. It's probably not the proposal I would have come up with had I been asked to reform the Davis Cup. But equally, everyone would probably have come up with a slightly different proposal.
What would you have gone with?
So yeah, I'd have basically copied the Ryder Cup, probably. I certainly wouldn't have made it annual. For me, that's crucial, for it to not be an annual event.
So 1 week a year, but every 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. And I know the problem with the Ryder Cup is it excludes, it's not global. It excludes certain territories in the world. So I'd have tweaked there.
Yeah, that wouldn't have worked, would it? Because you've got more than two countries. And otherwise, I mean, Ray, basically the Laver Cup is the Ryder Cup. All gets in the way.
Yeah, but that's annual as well. Yeah, I know. But I mean, very broadly speaking, I'd have copied that template as close as I possibly could, because as an individual sport trying to create a team event, it's the best. I mean, it is an absolute riotous success every single time. So yeah, I feel like, there are things that I would pick up and go, that's not ideal, that's not, but I'm prepared to give it a go. More importantly, I just don't want to see tennis tear itself apart. I don't want to see the warring factions. I want, even if it's not the ideal tournament or set of circumstances, I just want everyone to agree on it and say, okay, let's all unite and give this a go, and if it doesn't work, we'll try again and look at it again. But tennis tearing itself apart is very, very distressing. So I'm trying my best. I know it's not a very sexy opinion to have about the Davis Cup. It'd probably be a far more interesting podcast if I was doing a Yannick Noah and saying RIP Davis Cup and, reading a big eulogy out. But, you know, I just feel like let's keep an open mind and give it a go.
Ultimately, I share that view that, yeah, I'm sick of the power plays and the messiness of it all. I don't like seeing the Laver Cup and the Davis Cup trying to just get in each other's way. And, you know, all due respect to what Roger Federer has done, and the Laver Cup was a roaring success last year, etc. But don't try and get in the way of something that's that historic and that great. Try and make it work, people, for goodness sake. Just get together and sort this out for the good of the sport, because there's something in there that you're proving with the Laver Cup that team sports work. We've proved over the last 100 years that there's loads to love about the Davis Cup. Make it work, for goodness sake. Anyway, there was also a tie in Great Britain, a load of playoffs, in fact. The one we as British people took most interest in was certainly Britain somehow and ending up winning against Uzbekistan, despite the fact that Cameron Norrie lost from two sets up in his opening rubber. He got the win in the end in the fourth rubber. Dan Evans got a win in five sets as well. Charlie Eccleshare was there from The Telegraph in Glasgow, and I asked him what he made of the sort of atmosphere and the feel, whether it seemed any different, and what his views were generally. Obviously, you spoke to him on the podcast about the format generally. He said that there was definitely a sadness and an end of era feel. He said, I feel it's quite a weird situation because we don't know when we'll be back there, and also in Glasgow, and also it's uncertain just how different the home and away knockout ties will feel in the new format. It could be that even though they're shorter matches, 2 days, and less frequent, they'll still feel as special, or as good, but just in a different way. I think this weekend encapsulated a lot of the pros and cons. Two best of five singles is too much. On Friday, when you had Evans and Norrie playing in five sets, he said by the end of it, the place was deserted. And he said Leon Smith certainly believes that best of five is too long now. He said, I think the biggest loss is the dedicated doubles day. In that it makes Saturday special and a great atmosphere. I mean, that I'd definitely agree with that. The doubles, I hope the doubles feel is preserved generally, that it's still as good as ever. But the most jarring thing of the lot about this new proposal, from my view, is this idea that there will be wild card teams put into the finals, so that you'll have this playoff home and away process in February to decide who's going to join the four semi-finalists of the Davis Cup this year in next year's sort of November finals in Madrid or Lille or wherever they choose to play it. But then there's just a couple of teams that they're just going to throw in anyway because of goodness knows what reasons.
Into a Grand Slam quarterfinal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Wild cards in a World Cup, and that is how they're branding it. No, doesn't work.
No, and actually, Leon Smith today tweeted, "It's going to be very interesting to see how Davis Cup decide the wild cards for the 2019 finals. Quite a few nations, including ourselves, merit consideration. Hopefully, a very transparent and fair process. Let's see." I mean, it's right. Quite clear that he thinks
makes
it's a nonsense.
Exactly the point there. Transparency, however it is, it has to be transparent. I don't currently trust that it will be, but I hope to be proven wrong.
Well, what they've actually released details of the criteria or the process by which these wild cards are going to be decided. And Stu Fraser tweeted this. He said, two wild cards for the following year will be selected during the weeks of the finals event by the steering committee. So for 2020, it will be decided next November during the finals of the 2019 event. The steering committee will be made up of two ITF representatives, one organiser representative and one past player. A nation receiving a wild card must be ranked in the top 50 of the Davis Cup Nations ranking or have at least one player who's ranked in the top 10 of the ATP World Tour rankings. For 2019, the wild cards will be decided ahead of the qualifying draw, which incidentally takes place on the 26th of September. I mean,
it sounds wrong to me, David, and call me cynical. Many have. It sounds to me like it's an opportunity to ensure star power, that if there is a star player from a otherwise not strong tennis nation, one star standout player, that they want to be at the tournament to give it extra media attention and credit and all the rest of it, that they can ensure that they're there regardless of, you know, the performance of the country that they represent.
Yeah, that's the fear, certainly from my standpoint. For instance, Switzerland, who have Stan Wawrinka and Roger Federer, they lost in their match over the weekend in the final deciding rubber. They lost against Sweden, represented in this fifth rubber by Jonathan Mürder, who is ranked 1,094 in the world. He beat Switzerland's Sandro Errath, ranked 1,211 in the fifth and deciding rubber. So Switzerland won't be seeded in February when this draw is made in September 26th.
Did they pluck them out of the crowd?
So you've got, that is a concern for me.
I'm sure obviously they're still fantastically good tennis players, but that is, soon rankings won't go that low, will they?
Two players in the thousands played each other to decide a winner in a Davis Cup playoff. Could say that's the magic of the Davis Cup. But let's be honest, there will be a lot of people out there who want to make sure Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal and people like that are in these finals. And it really bothers me if that's going to be made to happen via this wildcard situation. Now, it might not be. Russell Fuller tweeted that surely South Africa should, one of the countries in Africa should have a representative in a World Cup. So maybe it will be skewed in order to give opportunity. I don't know. But my concern with this much money at stake is that star power, as you say, will be the determining factor. And that is just isn't the way World Cups work as far as I'm concerned. Yes, have the host nation in. I get that, like they do in the World Cup football. I understand that. But if it's moving around every year, if you're in the same country 5 years in a row, you can't keep putting the same country in. But anyway, that's a big concern. So we'll see. What else happened in the Davis Cup? Daniel Nestor retired, one of only six men to have 1,000 career match wins, including Connors, Federer, Brian Brothers and Lendl. Canada, incidentally, won 3-1. Denis Shapovalov came back from two sets to love down to win, and Milos Raonic won both of his singles rubbers. What else? Anything else quick catch your eye?
I think that's quite big for Denis Shapovalov coming back from two sets down. I think that's the first time he's done that in his career, isn't it?
I think it is. He came back from two sets to one down, didn't he, a couple of times after the US Open, or certainly once. But yeah, good win for him. So that's the Davis Cup. We wait to see what happens in that draw on the 26th of September.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Now, Catherine, did you hear my Enric Molina interview over the last few days?
I just can't stop making podcasts, David.
No, I was really supposed to
can't
have
let
a
go
break.
Of the Grand Slam dailies. Yeah. It was like, going to do an extra podcast.
I suddenly thought, oh, guess who I know? Enric Molina, let's have him on. I thought he was great to speak to. I did get quite a lot of correspondence off the back of it. A lot of people saying some nice things, but also some people questioning elements of what Enric said, questioning some elements of questions I did or didn't ask as well, which I'm perfectly happy to hear about as well if you have differing views. One of our listeners, Dennis Lee, who's a regular listener, did write to me at some length to question both Enric saying and me accepting his view that he has never treated a female player differently to how he's treated a male player. And Dennis quite fairly pointed out that, yeah, consciously, I'm sure he didn't treat women or doesn't treat women differently. the point is, does it happen subconsciously? And I think that that is a fair point, because
it's the point. Yeah.
So I do kind of wish I'd pushed that point with Enrique, although I'm quite sure he would have reacted with, oh, well, I don't think so. But that again is not the point, is it?
No. Yeah, no, I mean, I absolutely wouldn't expect him. You can't say, by definition, you can't say, yeah, oh, yes, I might have done unconsciously, because then it's conscious. So,
correct.
Yeah.
The story has moved on as well, more generally, with reaction on social media to Mary Carrillo's recent interview on NBC or CNBC or whatever it is. I can't remember exactly the channel. But she works for NBC, does Mary Carrillo. And she was very strident in her views that this situation wasn't as it was being painted to be by people that she has enormous respect for, like Billie Jean King. She just didn't agree with their view. She felt that Carlos Ramos wasn't at fault, certainly nothing like to the degree that was being painted, and that the chief problem was coming from Serena Williams. Now, she's faced some backlash from Jill Smoller, who's the representative of Serena Williams. We've also had Chris Clary's piece. Chris Clary from the New York Times wrote a piece explaining some statistics that had come to light about how there were more code violations given out to male players than there were to female players, which by association was saying that it disproves Serena's view that male players wouldn't have been treated the way she was treated. And her husband, Serena Williams' husband, Alex Ohanian Sr., has since responded to that today and really had a go at Chris Clary and pointed out today that the reason there are more, or those statistics showing that there are more male cases of code violations can only be justified if you're able to look at how many times, for instance, a male player has been guilty of cursing during a match in order to get a code violation for audio.
He's right. That is a crucial aspect. That's a crucial interpretation of the statistics that we have available to us in tennis is largely extremely poor. And that is, I agree with him. That's crucial information. It's not about net numbers of offences. It's not about net numbers of warnings. It's about net numbers of warnings relative to offences.
Mm. Yes, it is. However, I personally would have preferred a slightly different way of registering his complaint about it, rather than what felt a bit like grandstanding to me.
Yeah.
But he's then said that he will donate, I think it was $10 or $10, I think, for every word in the piece to a charity. I can't remember exactly which one it was. But yeah, by all means, go and do the independent research. I'd be very interested to see the results as well. I just feel that maybe Chris Clary didn't get it right, but I'd probably prefer not to be trying to sort of shame him publicly in quite the way that felt like it was doing.
So, yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah.
Incidentally,
publicly shaming is sadly where we are in the world. Anyway, yes. Yeah.
By the way, just a quick note. I mean, I think it hardly needs saying, but that cartoon in Australia was disgusting.
Yeah, it's a fantastically racist cartoon. Anyone that thinks it isn't, I don't know where to start. I shouldn't be reading articles by Rod Little, full stop, but an article by him saying, oh, you know, it's impossible to draw a cartoon of a black person without it being racist. Well, that very well might be the case. You know, white people draw, you know, discrimination, prejudice isn't just discrimination, it's discrimination plus power imbalance. And, you know, we still live in a world where there is a tremendous and egregious power imbalance between black people and white people. So maybe we haven't reached a stage yet of enlightenment where white people can draw cartoons depicting black people in an unracist way. But if you're in any doubt at all, I mean, any doubt at all, I think the biggest giveaway of the cartoon isn't actually how Serena is depicted. It's if you look in the background, the tiny little figure of Naomi Osaka, who is also a woman of colour. She's depicted as a little blonde white girl. So, you know, you've got the good, you know, the angelic good person depicted as white, and then you've got the looming figure of very dark-skinned Serena Williams in the foreground. So even if you don't take issue with how Serena is depicted, I think the relative depictions of the two, given that Naomi Osaka is very much also a woman of colour, I think is, yeah, it can leave you in absolutely no doubt.
Well said. Couldn't agree more. Incidentally, Carlos Ramos, one of the umpires at USA against Croatia in the Davis Cup, seen in conversation or pictured in conversation with Katrina Adams, the head of the USTA, was reported by one of the AP journalists as having made an apology, a private apology, not very private, but an apology to Carlos Ramos during their conversation. I wish that Katrina Adams, if she did feel like that, would just say it, you know, and let us all know.
She was perfectly happy to throw him under the bus publicly, so any subsequent backtracking on that should probably be fitting if that were public too. I mean, I only saw the photos. I don't know whether it's captured on video as well, but he looked remarkably magnanimous in that situation. I mean, my rage would have been boiling out of my ears, David. Can you imagine?
No, I'm scared to think about it.
So it looked to me like he was doing marvellously well. I suppose neutrality is part of the job for the likes of Carlos Ramos. But I think regardless of how you think he dealt with the situation, even if you think he was slightly in the wrong or slightly sexist or whatever, I don't see how you can possibly condone Kat Adams going on ESPN and just tossing him under the bus without a care in the world about it. Mm. Surely that, you know, regardless of her position personally or, you know, as an organisation, surely there has to be some even-handedness from the president, chairman, of the USTA about it. You know, we see both sides, etc., etc. So yeah, but I mean, she's not going to be in the post for much longer, so maybe she's less invested in the consequences of her actions, I suppose. But you think legacy might be a consideration. Anyway, well done Carlos Ramos for for not doing what Catherine Whittaker would have done in that situation and just sort of had a big tantrum, maybe.
Yes, that would have been entertaining in itself, almost worth just as an experiment. No. Grand Slams are going to stick with 32 seeds. A year ago, there was a proposal to reduce Grand Slams to 16 seeds, the idea being to try to make the first weeks of Slams more interesting and more potential for upsets. It does appear, and it doesn't appear unrelated, that there have been so many upsets in the first week of Slams this year that has probably been the death knell for that idea, for which I was quite enthusiastic, I have to say. I still like the idea of 16 seeds. Loads of people feel very differently to me. How do you feel about it?
I don't feel incensed. I didn't feel incensed at the prospect of them returning to 16 seeds, but equally, I just don't think it's necessary. And they've obviously realised that. It's nice to see a position on something that isn't so entrenched as to be sort of irrational. There seems to be a lot of that, just sort of pig-headed. No, this is our position, and regardless of developing events or changing landscapes, we are sticking with this entrenched position. You know, they've looked at how the Grand Slams have gone this year, and they've realised that perhaps the arguments in favour of it in the past don't so much apply anymore. And I think that's great because, yeah, the first week of Slams have definitely not disappointed this year. No. They've, if anything, you know, there's been too much carnage. of the top
I love players. Carnage is great.
Me too, but we do talk about, tennis does talk about the fact that there's a perfect amount of carnage, isn't there, where week two is still preserved, which makes week one exciting, but you don't end up with a disastrous, I'm not going to use examples because it would probably be disrespectful to the individuals involved, but you know.
I do know, but
you still want to have the showdowns in week two. You don't want to have, I don't know, US Open last year is probably an example, isn't it? Where both the semi-finals and the final were disappointing. All those players absolutely merited being there, but the level of carnage preceding that was probably, you know, for the average viewer, probably tipped into too much carnage.
Yes. Carnage overflow, in Catherine's view. Well, I would still like to see a specific tournament without any seeds. And I just want to see a bedlam draw. That'd
be fun as an experimental. Yeah, great. I'm up for trying that.
Okay, right. Well, we're doing that.
Sure.
The Catherine and David Open. The Tennis Podcast Open is going to be...
I mean, how far below 1,042, whatever it was, that the Swiss and Swedish... I mean, if they're getting call-ups, David...
Anyone can
enter. It can only be a matter of time. Yeah, hope remains alive.
And because it's our tournament, we get wild cards. That's how it works. Right, because that seems to be the new thing. Anyway, what else has happened over the last week? In terms of results, Heather Watson has reached the semi-finals in Quebec. She's actually having a decent couple of months as Heather Watson. She was beaten, I think, by Pauline Parmentier, who ended up winning the tournament. Quite a notable result in Hiroshima, won by Shea Souay, but really the headlines that occurred to me were the person she beat in the final, Amanda Anisimova, who you may remember we spoke about her, I think in about March time, when she was just 16 years old. She's now 17, but in the world's top 100. And apparently the first player born in 2001 to do exactly that, to reach the top 100 at the moment. And I don't know, I find her, of all the young players coming up, I find her probably just about the most exciting prospect that I've seen, because there just seems to be no weakness, no obvious downside to her game. But we'll see how it develops. On the subject of young players doing incredibly well, Jack Draper, who you may remember won the Wimbledon boys title.
Finalist. Wimbledon
was he finalist?
Boys.
Didn't he win it?
I think so.
Oh. No, you're
he
right.
Was a finalist.
Finalist of the Wimbledon
still
boys.
Still very good.
Yeah, still very good. Well done, Jack. Well, he decided not to play in the US Open Juniors, and he entered instead a 15,000 tournament in Nottingham, a futures tournament, which I saw a little clip of on somebody's mobile phone. About four people watching by the looks of it. But anyway, he won it. So well done, Jack. He now goes to Roehampton for another one. Then he goes to Nigeria for 2 weeks of 25K events. And Stu Fraser, our colleague, says he's the only 16-year-old in the world's top 1,000. So again, it's so difficult, isn't it, to know and to read how these people will transition and make this progression into the senior ranks. But I quite like the fact that he didn't play US Open Juniors and he's just starting to build that foundation.
Yeah, the guy's definitely got swagger, hasn't he? I mean, he was a great watch in that Wimbledon final. Definitely not afraid of a bit of showboating, which obviously is something that needs to be controlled and you know, deployed sparingly, I suppose. But it's nice sometimes with British juniors. When you dip your toe into watching junior tournaments at Grand Slams and you see the kids that are coming out of other countries and then you look at the British kids and they all look quite, you know, cookie cutter in LTA. I don't know, you look at someone like Jack Draper who, yes, probably is precocious and annoying, but you know, he can't help the fact that he's a 17-year-old boy. Most of them are. And I like that he's got a bit of swagger about him. And he's a bit different. I guess he's not very British, and I'm okay with that.
Well, when I think of the players who've come through those junior ranks and looked pretty angst-ridden about being on the circuit. I mean, you know, he talked about going off to Nigeria for a couple of weeks as though it was nothing. You sometimes see certain players clearly not relishing that side of the game, which is part of being a pro. I mean, crikey, and not 17 incidentally, he is just 16. And that's
16.
That's a very young age to be going off.
16-year-old boys are worse than 17-year-old boys.
Yeah, I know I was. But, I mean, crikey, the thought of me going anywhere on my own when I was 16 other than across the road to get some sweets, I mean, it wouldn't have happened. So, it's quite a big thing to do. So, good for him. Let's hope he's able to progress. A couple of pole vaults that I've run, Catherine. You can switch off now if you want. Don't groan. Serena Williams, I ran a poll about her tennis because I thought, you know, we're talking too much about non-tennis stuff here. So will she retire with 23, 24, 25 or more than 25 slams? She's currently on 23. What do you think?
Maybe 25.
29% agree with you, Catherine. The highest vote actually was for 35% going for just 23 slams. Think she won't win another one. Although that is negated overall, let's see, 65% think that she will win at least one more, and 21% think she'll win more than 25. How about this one then? Who do you think will retire with the most slams out of Federer, who's currently on 20?
I feel like you run these pole vaults like every week.
Every other slam? Every other slam, yeah. Because things happen. Catherine, as you know. Federer on 20, Nadal on 17, Djokovic on 14. So who's going to retire with the most slams? We had 2,153 votes.
I still think Federer will edge it.
How many is he going to have at the end?
Who he'll edge it from, I don't know. That wasn't the question,
I want to
David.
Know. Well, how many do you think he'll have? Do you think he'll win another one?
Yeah, maybe one more.
Okay. Nadal, 51% of people think that Federer will win the most. This is the most interesting one for me, is that 24% think Djokovic will win the most and 18% think Nadal. And so Djokovic, who's got three less than Nadal, more people think he'll end up winning more. What do you think?
I just said who Federer will edge it from. I don't know. I think Nadal will definitely win one more French Open and possibly one more something else. Let's say I think Nadal will win two more slams.
Okay, all right, I'll let you have that.
Minimum. So I think Djokovic will win more than two more, but whether he'll win six more... I think Djokovic and Nadal could end up on the same.
Well, did you know 7% of our voters think it'll be a draw between the three of them? Imagine that. Imagine how good the who's the greatest argument will be then.
Oh, don't, because then... Oh.
Then we'll have to get some tie breaks. Brilliant. Which have also been creating lots of arguments and loads of correspondence, which I've decided not to let you in on because you'll only pull your hair out. So, yeah, that's the pole vaults for this week, Catherine. Do you want to know what I think?
Sure.
Silence that end for about 2 seconds there. I think that Serena Williams will win 25. Yes, she will win 25. And so she'll win two more. And I think that Federer will just about edge it. And I agree with you. I think Nadal and Djokovic will be joint second, one slam behind. That's what I think.
So you think exactly the same as me?
Yeah. So I'm going to go... Right. I'm going to go...
Fascinating.
I don't think Federer's going to win another one. I think he's going to win... Stay on 20. I think Nadal... Hold on a minute. I think Nadal will win at least three more. Crikey. So I'm going to go dead heat. 20-20-20. There you go.
Ridiculous. The chances of that are very slim.
Imagine if I'm right. Get down the bookies. No, I don't bet. Right. I can tell you've had enough of me, Catherine. So shall we end this show at this point? We'll be back together next week, won't we? I bet you can't wait.
Yeah. You're too perky, David.
Brilliant. Well, okay. Well, this has been... Catherine's off for another nap. This has been the Tennis Podcast, brought to you in association with The Telegraph, with Amazon Prime Video UK. Don't forget, you can watch the Laver Cup streamed in more than 200 countries on Amazon Prime next weekend. It's going to be quite interesting, that, isn't it? Chicago, Djokovic is playing, no Nadal. Kyle Edmonds playing. That all makes it the whole Davis Cup conversation quite awkward as well, doesn't it? The number of players that are playing Laver Cup and didn't play Davis Cup. So anyway, we'll see that. We are executive produced by Melanie Bowes, SSS, tennisballs.com. Our mascot is Charlie the Ferret, and we are sponsored by La Manga Club. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.